folks, it's about 1 in 100,000 deaths from general anesthesia, in patients undergoing elective plastic surgery. And that number seems low, maybe it seems high to some, but to put it in perspective, the chance of getting hit by lightning is about 1 in 140,000.
Hey guys, it's Mel, your host of the Cutting Edge Podcast. This is a show where we talk transformation from every angle, body, mind, and confidence, with a little sparkle and a whole lot of truth. I'm joined by my amazing co-host, Dr. Omar Betas, and the plastic surgery pro, and Ashlyn Douglas Barnes, our go-to therapist and mindset queen. Now, quick disclaimer, none of us are your doctor or therapist. We are just here sharing real talk, real stories, and real growth. So grab your protein shake, settle in, and let's get into it. This is The Cutting Edge.
Hey, it's Ashlyn. Just one more thing before we begin. I will be sharing some of my own plastic surgery journey, which is personal to me and may not reflect what others go through. And if you're a current client of mine, please talk with me first before listening, because knowing personal details about me could affect your therapy. And your well-being always comes first. Now on to the show.
Welcome back to the Cutting Edge Podcast. As you know, I'm your host, Mel, and I am here with my two experts. I have Dr. Betas, and I have Ashlyn Douglas Barnes, who is a bariatric therapist. So welcome, everyone else, to the show.
We have a good topic tonight.
We do have a great topic tonight. So tonight, if you guys don't know what we're trying to do here, we're basically making sure you guys are safe at all times. That's why we're breaking everything down, so that way you guys know what to do. You've heard already in the past episodes about like how to pick your surgeon, what insurances, how you should check your insurance and things like that. Now we're going to be talking about fears, because we know you guys have them. I do too, and I haven't done it yet. So there's fears here. And then we're going to actually talk about anesthesia. So we're going to like break it down into little segments for you, because each one is just so important. So, alrighty, guys, you want to jump in?
Yeah, so I would say this is one that comes up a lot in therapy, that this is a fear that people have surrounding anesthesia, which I always find interesting for bariatric patients, because we've resolved potentially a lot of the concerns surrounding anesthesia, and bariatric surgery anesthesia is probably a lot more risky than the anesthesia we would be having now. But this is definitely something that comes up in therapy as like what is preventing certain people. I think of particularly like my mom's or my dad, like where they're worried, like if I did this and then something happened to me, how would my children react? I think there's been some celebrities happened to. And so that's the back of some people's mind. But I don't really know if the data actually like fits
the fear.
That fear. Yeah.
Okay.
I think you bring up a great point, Ashlyn. We've had, I would say, a lot of our moms, especially younger moms, or right, like 30s, 40s, they have kids under 5 or 10 or however old they are. They're ready to do their mommy makeover, let's say, or have their, you know, plastic surgery after weight loss procedure. And they're afraid of like potentially something terrible happen and like leaving their kids behind, right? Fortunately, it's extremely rare. So to answer your question about like the statistics, we covered this in one of our hot topics. It's about 1 in 100,000 deaths from general anesthesia, in patients undergoing elective plastic surgery. And that number seems low, maybe it seems high to some, but to put it in perspective, the chance of getting hit by lightning is about 1 in 140,000.
Hey friends, this episode is sponsored by findabariatrictherapist.com, because bariatric life is full of ups and downs and everything in between, but you don't have to go through it alone. findabariatrictherapist.com makes it easy to connect with therapists who truly understand your journey, the mindset shifts, the identity changes, and all the real life challenges that come after surgery, because therapy designed for bariatric patients changes everything. Visit findabariatrictherapist.com and find your support today.
The chance of dying from a car crash is 1 in 93 in a lifetime. So something we do every day, most of us do every day. Yeah. And our, you know, every day in our lives, probably multiple times a day, you get in your car and drive to work, drive home, drive to the grocery store. The risk of that is a lot higher than dying from general anesthesia. So I think it's a pretty low chance. You have to make sure you have a good surgeon, a good anesthesia team. I think, you know, you want to make sure you're not getting your surgery done in someone's garage or basement.
Or motel or hotel. Please.
Motel, no. Hotel, Holiday Inn.
Holiday Inn. Legit.
So I think as long as you're doing it safely, the risks are very low, you know, in general.
What are the complications that people have from anesthesia? I think I mainly just think of like the scariest one, which is death. But like, I would imagine there's a lot of other things that can happen from anesthesia or people are worried about will happen, or maybe some that can happen but are not realistic, but people fear them.
So, you know, so let's talk about, there's kind of two parts, right? I mean, this, I guess, is a little bit more, but you can, under surgery, there's two ways someone can die, right? One is from the surgery itself, right? Like you hit an artery, you hit the aorta, you bleed out, right? That's one way. That's a surgical death, I would say, not so much an anesthesia death. Luckily, in plastic surgery, what I tell patients is, we're not working anywhere near any big vessels, right? Unless you're a bad surgeon and you've lost your way and you're just digging around, not near the aorta, we're not near the femoral vessels, we're not working near anything big that if you hit it, it's going to bleed to the point where someone can die. At least not the type of plastic surgery that I do. Skin removal. Skin's very superficial, right? Skin fat. Usually the worst thing is you hit somewhat of a big vessel, but it's nothing critical. It's just going to the skin and you can get it controlled. So death from the surgeries itself are very low. Now, again, is it impossible? No. And especially if you see, I mean, we had a guy here in town. He was a gynecologist doing liposuction 5 or 6 years ago, I think the story was. And you hear these stories all over the country. He did lipo, didn't know what he was doing, hit this lady's, you know, artery, aorta. He hit her colon, her liver, her pancreas, and she died pretty much. I mean, probably didn't survive. She was probably dead when she left there. Not really. She might have had a heartbeat, but she died in the hospital like later that day. And again, these happen all over the country because of people who aren't trained in these procedures doing risky procedures.
Yeah.
So the risk of that, I think, is extremely, extremely low, probably less than 1 in 100,000. Now, the risks of anesthesia that Ashlyn, I think you were just asking about, generally are going to be something like, you know, they put the ET tube, that's the breathing tube that they put in. Maybe they put it down the esophagus now, you know, which happens again, it's very rare. Now they're not, and they didn't notice that they did that. There's a lot of checks to make sure that that's done properly. So that's pretty rare. Usually pick that up pretty quickly and then switch it, back to, into the trachea where it belongs. But even that, at that point, when you say you pull, usually it's going to be a pulmonary problem. You pull the breathing tube. The patient has what's called a laryngospasm. That's where the larynx kind of clamps down and now you're not getting oxygen into the lungs and you don't have that secure airway, right? That tube is a secure airway. It's connected to a machine that's delivering oxygen to you. But once you pull that tube and the patient has that spasm, if the anesthesia provider doesn't recognize that quickly, it can be difficult to correct. Again, that's probably where that 1 in 100,000 comes from.
Okay.
And then the last one would be, I mean, usually something from anesthesia is going to be a cardiac problem, like a heart problem, or a lung problem. So we've talked about the lung problem. The cardiac problem could be any one of a number of things that kind of triggers the heart to have some kind of abnormal beat or to stop beating, right? So medications, some kind of weird reaction, just the stress of the medications that you get when you're under anesthesia. Again, in healthy people, these are all extremely rare. So it's different for the patient who's going in for a mommy makeover or skin removal than the patient who had a heart attack and is heading back to the operating room. And we know their heart's in bad condition and they're about to undergo general anesthesia. And you don't have a choice because if you don't take that patient to the OR, they're going to die. But there's also a high risk putting them under general anesthesia because anesthesia is a stress on the heart as well. But again, I think these are all extremely, extremely low risk in a healthy patient.
Yeah. Well, and for, I would guess for plastic surgery on that last one, right? Because there's no way you would take someone that's like that distressed and do plastic surgery on. So.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing with elective surgery is it's not even comparable to like an orthopedic surgery where someone needs a knee or a hip replacement. Right. Those are somewhat urgent. I mean, you can push them off. And you might do it on someone who's a little unhealthier, has like, you know, obstructive sleep apnea, that's a risk factor, or has had a heart history. with plastic surgery, if you see someone safe, I mean, my nurse harps for me on this all the time, but I get tons of clearances on my patients. None of my patients get surgery unless you're like 20 and you're super, super healthy. I get a clearance on almost all my patients and all of my weight loss patients because they've had some surgery that's altered their anatomy. They have a lot of sometimes lab abnormalities that we want to make sure we investigate. So all my weight loss patients get a medical clearance at the minimum. And if you see a specialist like a pulmonologist because you have obstructive sleep apnea or a cardiac doctor because you've had a heart attack or stroke in the past, then you're getting extra clearances from those doctors as well.
Oh, so that's a good thing, people. Like, you at least get all the clearances. So that makes me feel way more comfortable. I guess with anesthesia, like what is it doing exactly to your body? Do you know? Are you able to explain that?
To some degree, I mean, you know, the purpose of anesthesia is so we can operate and you don't remember, which is amnesia. And then anesthesia is don't feel pain, right? At least during the operation. So it's a series of medications. And obviously, if you have allergies, we want to make sure we take those into account. One of the riskiest things is someone who has something called malignant hyperthermia, which is usually genetic. That's one of the first questions they ask, like if you have a history of that or a family history of that. That means we have to avoid specific medications during surgery. And that can be something that it can be like fatal pretty quickly in the operating room if it's not identified. So, okay. You know, we have special precautions for that. There's like a kind of a malignant hyperthermia cart. There's usually a protocol we have to follow if we start to identify it. And again, we have all types of like checks and balances to make sure that if it is identified, there's a quick solution to it.
If someone had surgery before and they're having it again, would that be an indication that they don't have that condition?
Correct.
They've already had anesthesia. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So for a lot of the patients have already gotten bariatric surgery.
Correct. Yeah. You know, you don't have it if you didn't have a problem the first time. Yeah.
Okay.
So your question was what it does. So, you know, basically the goal is to keep you asleep and sedated. And, you know, people always say like, please, I don't want to wake up in the middle of surgery. That's a terrible myth that keeps kind of propagating or old wives' tale, because it doesn't happen. I mean, it's physically impossible. You have a breathing tube down. Nothing is going to suddenly like make you wake up and realize that you're having a procedure.
That's just the movies, people. It's just the movies.
Yeah.
But that is that's Hollywood. The fear that comes up. People are afraid they're going to wake up. They're going to remember it. They're not going to be able to move. So they're going to be awake, but you won't know. And then they'll feel
movie
everything.
About that. Awake, right? Isn't that the name of it? It was called Awake or something.
I think it might be.
I have more clients that tell me that they fear that more than death, because
it's Hollywood. I mean, it's all Hollywood.
That's a big fear. I get that one. Like being like literally where you can see everything, but you can't communicate and you can't move your body. Like that's like the worst.
There is a thing with like Twilight where some people like don't go down enough, specifically in Twilight. So like you can have like a colonoscopy and they have to like remed mid, but that's because it's a different kind of anesthesia. Like,
yeah, Twilight, that's. So Twilight, which is, you know, Twilight anesthesia is, I think, typically what people refer to as IV anesthesia, where you don't have a breathing tube down. You're not fully asleep. In some cases, you can follow commands even. You probably may not remember, right? So there's different types of medications. There's medications to help you with anxiety. There's medications to help you with kind of memory, and the anxiety ones can help you forget as well, right? That's when people have conversations either before or after surgery and they don't recall them. It's usually one of those medications. Some are to control heart rate, breathing, things like that, and blood pressure. Those are some of the medications you might get while you're asleep under general anesthesia. And then there's paralytics. You're not going to use a paralytic in Twilight anesthesia, right? Because then the patient's going to stop breathing. We're not controlling their breathing under IV anesthesia. They're breathing on their own. We're just giving them medications to make them more relaxed, and forget and not have memory of the event. Under general anesthesia, we don't use a lot of paralytics because we're not really working around muscles. But some surgeons, or if you're doing specific surgery that where you're maybe going around a muscle, cutting a muscle, you don't want the muscle to contract. So you might give them a paralytic, but that in that case, you have a breathing tube down. You have a control, that's called a controlled airway, right? That's the safest airway you can have. But the machine's doing the breathing, so you can paralyze that person and now they're no longer breathing on their own. The machine is breathing for them.
That kind of freaks me out. I'm not gonna
lie. Yeah.
Makes sense. That would be a fear. Okay. Another fear.
And that's where that fear comes from, but it's totally unfounded in, you know, medical possibilities, I guess.
I have clients that are fearful that they are going to do something, say something embarrassing. They're going to lose their ability to hold their bowels, their bladder. They're going to tell you their deepest, darkest secrets. They're going to say that they love you, even though they've never met you, and try to do something inappropriate. Like, people come up with interesting anxieties that I'm like, wow, I would never think of that. But like, what are the... Like, I would imagine that, especially like bowel movement and all, and if it happened, it's like you're in an OR, like you're matter. In the best place to have it.
Yeah. So there are, you know, in addition to the paralytics, there's kind of relaxing agents, anxiolytics, which can, I mean, yeah, we've had patients pee or have bowel movements in the OR. I mean, everyone's a professional. We clean things up and keep moving. Usually
they wouldn't even know, either, right?
Like you wouldn't. No, tell we them. Would. We yeah. definitely wouldn't oh, tell them. Yeah, no, yeah. absolutely not. I mean, you either hope it happens at the very beginning of the case before you've made any cuts and everything's just, you clean it up before you start, or at the very end when everything's kind of dressed. Hopefully it's not like on your dressings if you're working on the thighs, for example. It happens. Again, it's very rare.
Happened, but it's not like a thing. It's not like when we have babies and we typically poop. Like that's
yes, higher. It's not that common. No, I mean, okay. It probably happens. I mean, we do hundreds of surgeries a year. I can count like on one hand the number of times it happens in a year, if even. Yeah.
Perfect. So see, people, that's an easy fear to not have to worry about, for sure. Yeah. So why, I have a feeling I know why this, but why are you, you've said it twice, of like you're trying to make sure they don't remember. So is it really that traumatic for our brain to see us go under?
No, not so much, but generally a lot of the anxiolytics you get. So, you know, one of the first things, it's not common, but a lot of patients, like the first thing when I see them to mark them, right? That's kind of the first time I'm going to see them that day. And we're making conversation, like, how's it going? You know, what questions do you have? And they're like, I'm really nervous. Mm-hmm. And so for us, we mark patients standing up, right? So my nurses know not to give any of those anxiolytics because they can kind of make you drowsy and sleepy or give you weak knees. And I need you to stand up to be able to mark you. So they know not to give those medications until after I've marked, because now the patient's going to get back in the stretcher and they're not going to have to get up again.
Okay, good.
And so a lot of those kind of anti-nerves, that's anti-anxiety medications, will make your memory a little foggy. So you may not remember conversations either before or after surgery. And that's also why they tell you, like, can't drive home yourself right after general anesthesia. Can't make any decisions. Like, don't sign any paperwork or contracts. Like, don't close in your house that day. Don't sign your marriage, you know, kind of things like that. Divorce paperwork, like none of that stuff you can do because you're not in a clear mind. And it's not, so the purpose isn't to make you forget. It's just to take the edge off. But the side effect is that it can affect your memory.
Got it. No, that makes
and
sense.
Then I think Ashlyn, you might have mentioned, you know, they're afraid that they're going to tell someone something that they regret. I don't know. I mean, no one's ever told me they love me. I can tell you that much. Not a patient.
I just think it's
a
loss of control fear. Mm-hmm. Like when I think of the mental health, like I would do something very embarrassing, loss of control. I would do something I wouldn't do otherwise that then my partner would feel a certain way about. Like it's more of a like pretty unrealistic fear, but I think the loss of control is pretty scary for a lot of people. Like, I'm going to fully give up control 100%. Oh, there's another one I just thought of. But
I think there are. So I'm not there in the room when a patient's going to sleep. But sometimes when we get in there, they're already, and at that point, they're already, when I say asleep, like we're talking intubated, the sterile field's up, we're ready to go. But obviously some of the team members are. And it's funny because every once in a while, like we get in, they're like, oh, this patient was telling us this or patient was telling us that. I don't think anything has ever been said that's like super embarrassing. It's usually like, oh, she was telling us, you know, she likes to make cakes on the weekends, or like she sells cakes for a hobby or whatever it is. I'm making these stories up now because I can't remember specific situations. We kind of talk about it and we move on, and then we're talking about something else 2 minutes later. I don't remember any like nothing in front of me, at least, that I remember was embarrassing, and nothing that anyone's ever brought up.
Well, that's good. Look at that.
Yeah.
How about like in the waiting room when anesthesia, or the post-op when anesthesia, again, I've had clients that are like, well, what if I did something crazy when I was coming out of anesthesia and I hurt someone? Like I got wild, because they've heard that some people vomit or they get wild and they're afraid. I always tell, like, talk to them about that fear because we can met it if it happens. But
I think something maybe interesting, the most common side effect of anesthesia is postoperative nausea and vomiting, right? There are lots of medications for that. The most common one we use, I think pretty much every patient gets it, is a little patch. Almost just like a little, like one of those circular band-aids, you put it on the back of the neck because it's a topical, a kind of a patch medication. Mm-hmm. And that does wonders for patients. So it's pretty rare. Again, it's the most common. That doesn't mean it happens to like 90% of patients. It's maybe like 5-10% of patients. Most of them get over it within a few hours at the most a day. And then in terms of after surgery, I'd say young men are known to wake up swinging. It's very kind of a known thing. They wake up combative. They will swing. So, we take precautions. Again, there's going to be maybe multiple people around that patient, just kind of holding the hands to make sure they're not waking up swinging and punching someone. People have gotten hurt. But again, I mean, that's
It happened to Dad Rob when he came out of surgery for bariatric surgery. So he said it in his episode. I was like,
oh, did
what? Yeah. And he's like, yeah, I punched a lady. And I was like, oh, no. Yeah.
And I think it's some
And he's a big guy.
He's a big guy. Nicest guy. The worst one to do it to. Like, such a nice guy.
So I know. I'm sure you feel terrible, right? But again, like, it's out of your control. Right.
And you would never, charge someone in that situation. Okay, yeah.
Probably goes to like your workman's comp or something, but you can't. Right. Yeah, you wouldn't be able to charge a patient with it.
I was gonna say because my mom, as a hospice nurse, she gets hit, so it's like.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's different if you're a patient in the hospital and you've been there like 2 weeks, and then you take a swing at someone, right? Yeah. But yeah, you can't charge someone who's waking up from anesthesia with the.
Usually the
arms may be like tied or something or restrained or again just being held by someone just to make sure they don't wake up, but. You know, someone who's like fit or someone who's big or strong and muscular, you're probably going to overcome, you know, like your 140-pound nurse who's standing and holding your arm. Yeah. So
that's fair. That's fair.
I've seen some guys at the gym lift like, 140 with one arm. So that's not me. Maybe one day.
Holy moly. That's wild.
I think, too, it's important, like anyone who has any underlying mental health concerns to like deal with them. Because I would imagine this is when a lot of that comes out, particularly you're going to be put asleep with other people and other people are going to be there and they may be men and they may be women. It may be a mix. So it's probably important to talk to someone about it, talk to your surgeon if that's a thing. And, because I think anesthesia brings up people think of the surface of it, but I think there's also a level of lack of control. And then who's in the room, your sleep, what are the liability for what could happen to you?
Well, and they've heard of people doing crazy stuff to you while you're under anesthesia. It's more dentist weird shit than I've ever heard of, but that's the deal.
We want to know what dentist examples. I'm not sure.
Oh, yeah. There's PG? Been several. Oh, so. No, none of it's PG.
Oh, boy.
Just this week, there's an OBGYN that had a phone in his pocket and he was videoing exams and the baby's being born.
That's weird.
Oh, terrible.
That was local to Central Florida.
There was that one guy, too, who didn't he use a, he was like a IVF doctor and there's like a Netflix special on that. He used a sperm to impregnate like 600 or 700 women or something like that.
That's like narcissism on another level. Like, that I should have a collection of soldiers that are like me. I don't know.
Army.
He had a thank you. I was like, what's the word I'm looking at? But he had a complex too that he was going to be the best. That was a very.
I didn't watch it. I should watch it. That sounds interesting.
It creates some interesting conversations surrounding a lot of things. But yes, I do think he had a complex. But
you read those stories, but those are the bad apples, right? I mean,
right. Yes.
We hope that those are like the 1%ers, less than 1%ers. We hope they don't exist ideally, but they're out there. And I don't think it's by far anywhere close to even it's a very small minority, right? So I think, Ashlyn, just to touch to your point about, fears and that kind of thing. I mean, everyone in that room is a professional, right? Whether it's your nurse, your anesthesia provider, the scrub tech, those are the people that hand us instruments. the surgeon or anyone else in the room. Sometimes there is representatives from a company. If we're using a product, it might be there. But everyone's a professional. They're not there to make fun of you. They're not there to laugh at you. I mean, we like to laugh, but we're not going to laugh at patients. So I think a lot of that fear maybe can go away when people understand this is what we do for a living. We're not here to right. joke about something that happens to someone, especially when they're under anesthesia.
Talk to my patients to let them know there is an entire team there. So if they were going to do something evil to you, the entire team mm-hmm. would have to be in on it. And that would probably be really challenging, especially in hospital settings that have levels of different people that are involved who would then be at different levels. Like it wouldn't
That's
just
a great
be,
point. Yeah.
Like when, I mean, do you guys generally have a rule that like the patient cannot be alone under general, like, is there rules that like.
It's, I mean, I guess it's a rule, but it's probably, I don't know if there's a law. It's definitely a hospital rule. Like, I mean, for example, like if my scrub tech, again, this is just, I mean, I'm not trying to downplay what they do, but it's the person who hands us instruments and they do counts to make sure all the instruments are there before and after, we're not missing anything. So it's a very important part, but like if they want to take a pee break and I'm at a point where like, let's say I'm doing lipo, right? I don't need instruments handed to me. I've got the lipo cannula in my hand and I'd be doing 20, 30 minutes, an hour of lipo. If they need to take a bathroom break, someone has to come in and relieve them because they can't leave the patient. So, yes, I don't know. Again, I don't know if it's a law or a rule, but it's definitely a hospital policy that like you can't, you know, the scrub tech can't leave the room without another scrub tech there. Even though sometimes it might be silly because I may not need them like for the next five, you know, how long does it take to go to the bathroom? 5 minutes. Right. But they can't leave. And you made a good point. The point about like multiple levels. I don't know if you guys heard the story about the plastic surgeon who was at the University of Miami, he did something like and put it on Instagram. There was also some like liver, I think it was a liver transplant doctor. I don't remember what state he was in. He would like, you know, using the electrocautery, like write his name on the liver. That's how he got caught. I mean, whoa. It might happen, but if it happens in a place like the OR, you're going to get caught. Like someone's going to say something, you hope, and that person's not going to be around much longer. So,
yeah, because I think that's another,
another tick for like, you want to have this done in a setting that has that level to it. Mm-hmm. So the chop shops of like, we're trying to go as fast as we can and the anesthesia, the whole team may just be on to the next and on to the next. You may be left alone.
And that's
versus in a setting that is backed by a hospital or an outpatient or like
or
there's
surgery
some
center,
other
yeah.
level. Not to say that, you know, in like reputable doctors shouldn't do it like in an office, but I think there is like a level to where it's like, okay, part of what you pay for in some of these settings are all the people that are involved and the, all the layers then of security of that fear. And again, we hope that that never happens, but I definitely have had clients bring that up and be like, I don't want to say anything because I don't want to upset the doctor. But that is something I think about and I worry about. And I'm like, that makes sense. So let's like back it up with some facts of like, what would the, like how many people would actually be in the room? Like maybe that's a question under in my situation or for the surgeon in my situation, how many people would be in the room and like having that information to kind of back the fear, because at the end of the day, you don't have control. You will be asleep. So it is a risk that you take. And so with reasonable, you know, when we look at like weighing that risk, we want to have reasonable information or factual information.
Well, I think that's a great question that we should tell people to ask. If this is a fear of yours, like when you go see Dr. Betas and he does all the stuff, you can ask him right there of like, hey, how many people are in the OR when this happens? Like, so that way he can tell you.
Five.
There you go. Five people. And that's including you.
One, two, three, four. Sorry. Four. So anesthesia, surgeon, the circulating nurse, right? So that's the person who stays unsterile, like, hey, I need the suture. Well, sutures are kept in a cabinet, but they're not sterile immediately, right? They come in an unsterile package. And so your circulating nurse is going to hand that to your scrub tech, and that's the fourth person. And I would say 99.9% of the time I have a PA or nurse practitioner who's with me. So, I mean, the minimum is four, but usually we're five people in the room.
Okay. So, yeah. So think about that, because when you, Ashlyn's right, like you're paying for this. So those people should be in there when you go under. Like you should, you probably see them, right? When you go under, like they're around you.
Yeah, you'll see
so
at least when you first go in the room, three people. I won't be there because I'm not part of the team putting you to sleep, but yeah.
Okay. So you're going to see some of these people there. So if you don't, maybe ask a question before you lay down. Be like, where's all the people? If that's one of your fears, I mean, just, I think if you can get in front of it as much as you can, maybe even to help this fear, Dr. Bates, what do you guys listen to music? What kind of things do you chat about? Like what, that way they understand what's happening.
Yeah. So for us, and I mean, I think it's going to be different everywhere, but for us, generally we dim the room lights down. Okay. Your anesthesia provider, because it could be someone different, they might ask you to count back from 10. I mean, I think when I had a procedure, that's what they made me do, from 10 or from 100. I can't remember. I think for them, it's like some inside thing, like how far can someone get?
Yeah.
How quickly can I get this person down? Which is, again, not, it's just kind of a maybe a metric that they use. And then we usually do play music. I think if the patient doesn't really have a preference, which we can always put whatever on, like we have YouTube connected to the system speakers. If they don't pick something, we'll just put like some kind of calming, like Othman waves or like, I don't want to say elevator music. It's kind of like calming music, okay, like what you might get at a spa.
I have never gone into the OR and there be calm music. I have always gone and that to me is always the part that I like to know. It's like, what kind of music?
Do you remember that part, though?
Yeah. So I am a weird case. They don't do the anesthesia part because I'm weird with anesthesia. And so they actually start to wrap me and I'm still awake. So like when they put your arms in the box, the like foamy boxes and all that, I'm still awake because how the anesthesiologist did it was, I've had that happen a couple times. So yeah, no, there's still.
But you also have a, like you, I remember you mentioned in previous episodes, you have something weird with anesthesia where you need more.
Yeah, I need.
So have they given you anything, though, before you've gone back, or you haven't received anything until you've gotten to the OR?
No. So I know the music is playing. I know it is cold. I know I usually put myself on the bed. And it's weird because you put your arms out. I always think that's kind of weird. And I always think when I get anesthesia, am I going to remember this part? Am I going to remember this part?
Yeah, like which part?
I do think the biggest surprise to patients is how cold the rooms are. That's probably like, if you've never been in one, right? Like for your bariatric surgery, Mel, I don't know if that was your first, but, and if you remember,
it's cold.
It's cold. That's the first thing people always comment.
Because how cold do you have to have it?
You don't have to have it cold. People, I mean, we tend to keep it cold just for infection prevention. But on the flip side, for my surgeries, we tend to try to keep it a little warmer. I'm not going to say it's always successful because you're like fighting 65 degree temperatures from like, you know, the night before or the day before.
Okay.
We try to warm it up closer to like 70 because we have long cases. And unlike, you know, like a surgery on the abdomen where you're working internally, we might expose like neck to knees, right? And so that whole skin is exposed and your skin's your largest organ, right? So people lose a lot of heat, especially when it's a cold room. So one of the things we do is we try to put one of those like warming blankets on patients in the pre-op area. That's actually been found to be the most effective way to keep someone warm. And then we also try to preheat the rooms before you go in, but it's probably, even if you go in at like 68, 69, 70, that's kind of chilly. Mm-hmm. So it's still going to feel cold to patients.
Not when I've had plastic surgery, but when I've been at Mayo, there's this gown thing and there's a tube you hook up to it.
Air hugger.
And it shoots hot air in there.
It's the warming blanket.
Is the best, except for, oh, I always thought you were talking like an actual like coming out of the blankets that are in like the heater. But yes, the like robe that hooks up to a tube.
Called a bear hugger, but B-A-I-R.
Yeah. Those
Whoever invented that is a billionaire, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. And like stupid easy idea. Like put a gown that you shoot hot air.
Exactly. But though, so that's actually, like I said, that's the most effective way, in talking about fears, one of the ways that you can trigger bleeding or kind of stop someone's bleeding is if they get too hypothermic, right? So if your temperature gets too low, which again, that's one of the things the anesthesiologist is watching, you can have more bleeding and it's your clotting factor stop working. So those warming blankets, usually very good before surgery. And that's why for us, we try to preheat the room because once your temperature starts to drop, it's a lot harder to bring it back up. But we have other things, like we have something called an under blanket warmer. So usually on the bed. Again, this is for us. I'm not sure everyone's going to have this, but the bed you're going to come to on the operating room table mm-hmm. has a mat, almost like a very thin water bed, if you want to think of it that way. Okay. And then the water is being pumped in and out of a machine that's heating that water, and it sits underneath you. And then we also have little tricks. Sometimes we can actually put kind of a balloon down the esophagus that also can run warm water. That's the most, other than the warming blanket before in the operating room, that's the best way we can keep you warm.
Well, balloon in your esophagus?
Yeah, it's kind of, again, a water balloon. It goes into the esophagus and the same pump. It's the same pump we use on the bed. It can pump hot water in. So it's just heating the water and it's pumping that water down into the balloon in your esophagus. And then that's radiating in, warming your body. And then the cold water is coming back out, being warmed in the machine and back in.
So you do.
We unlock a new set of fears now.
No, yeah, no,
a little bit.
I'm trying to envision how that would work, but I guess it's going down into your down. Core.
Yeah, it's not like inside your body in any. I mean, I guess it's inside a cavity, but it's not like inside a vessel or anything.
I think so. I just don't like a balloon down there. That's all. That feels awkward. But do you do that to all patients?
We do that on anything generally longer than 4 hours because, again, you lose so much heat because those are my big cases, like a lower body lift. You're going to be exposed neck to knees. So the amount of heat that you lose in that room, even if it's set at like, we can't set it at 75 degrees, right? Like we can't, that's too hot for us to work in because we're in gowns. And then, you know, you don't want like sweaty surgeons, there's sweat dripping down on your body. That's not good for sterility. So, you know, we'll set it at like 69, 70, but that's still cold for a patient. So, that is the, if we can't keep temperatures up, we will use that. And generally, like I said, that's going to be on our more than 4 hour cases. It's a very effective way to warm a patient.
That makes sense. Like, I mean, when I drink hot tea or you guys have hot coffee, like it warms us real fast. So
that's true.
Yeah. It's a good analogy, actually. I'm going to start using that. No?
Yeah, dude. Because I chilled myself once and it was real bad because I like ice. And I had like, I don't have my thing in here. My whole tumbler was filled and it was like Sonic ice. So I just sat there and was eating. And it was literally like getting it a handful, clumping it up and then eating like snow. And then I was like almost all the way through it. And I was like, oh my God, I'm so cold, like bone shivering cold. Yeah. And my ex-husband was like, go get some tea. And I was like, ooh. And so it was like hot tea and then boom, right back to normal. I was like, yep, here we go. So
yeah, it is a very efficient way to warm someone.
Yeah. Okay. So that's what's going to happen when I go to you. Got it. Check mark. Yeah.
Yeah.
How about fears surrounding, like, sometimes I'll have clients that'll worry about, like, they have undiagnosed sleep apnea or they have some kind of medical issue surrounding breathing or their, like, lung is going to collapse because they heard that can happen. Like, what kind of precautions?
Undiagnosed sleep apnea, I imagine if it's to the point where it's undiagnosed, I guess it's possible, probably can't be that bad.
Right.
Because if you're obstructing, usually your partner's going to know, right, snoring. Are you going to wake up multiple times a night? You got to sit up or do something. I can't imagine it's too severe if it's undiagnosed. Again, anesthesia is very good about screening their patients, right? So just like we have things that we ask, they have very specific questions they ask. Like they look at the neck angle. They're going to ask you to like open your mouth. Yeah. Well, maybe. I don't know that they all do, but they look at the angles. They're going to, the length of the neck, they're going to ask you to like open your mouth, stick out your tongue. You probably had them do that like the morning of surgery, unless you had like a PAT appointment. Yeah. So they're looking at anatomy to see, is this airway, right? Their concern is like here and then the heart, but is this airway easy? Am I going to have a hard time? Do I need to bring a camera in, which a lot of like, patients going to sleep now are using a little camera. That way they know they're going into the trachea, not the esophagus.
So
I would say those are all, yeah. Won't make any jokes because this is going to go down the wrong path here. But what was the question?
People who have fears around undiagnosed like sleep apnea. Some kind of a lung collapsing. I don't know. Like people have heard all sorts of things and they come in, they're like, what if my lung collapsed? I'm like, it probably would be the best place for your lung to collapse because you're literally in an OR.
Correct. Yeah, I was going to say, again, not common. I mean, again, is it a risk? Yes. Extremely rare. I don't think I've ever had it happen to a patient. And if it's going to happen, they're going to pick up on it pretty quickly, right? Again, they've got you on monitors. It's a pretty easy fix. You have to inflate the lung back in. You have to put a little needle just to decompress it. But if it's going to happen, like you said, that's the best place for it to happen. Mm.
That's actually what calms me, is knowing, like, well, I'm around professionals, so.
Right.
They'll fix it. They don't want you to die. They want you to live. Yeah,
that is what, let me tell you, what I tell every single client who's worried. I said, the surgeon wants you to die as much as you do. I'm like, because that is not good for them if you die. It is not good for their...
Doesn't want you to die.
Right.
Doesn't want you to die.
Oh, okay. I feel like you misspoke there.
Did I say they do want you to die?
I think you did. Maybe you want you to live.
Oh, my God. No, they do not want... They want you to die as much as you do. They don't want you to die. So that is correct.
Oh, I get. I guess I see what you're saying.
Yeah. Okay. So, phew. Okay. No, but for real, because
maybe say I want you to live as much as you do.
Right. But I think when my clients are like, well, I'm really afraid, I'm like, that would be awful for the surgeon. Like, the liability insurance is what comes up first, but that should be
malpractice. Yeah.
Your malpractice. I mean, it's not good for your reputation. That's what I was trying to think of. Like,
oh, yeah.
All of that. I mean, your own feeling about things, like, they don't want you to die. They're not going to take on a case for elective surgery that they think may put their career at risk.
I like that.
Again, yeah, for the most part, I think there's always like the bad apple out there. But there's always the bad apple. But no, I think good surgeons, safe surgeons, ethical surgeons, that's not what we're looking to do. Like, I am not, we're in a profession where there's enough work to go around. At least this is the way I feel. I don't need to take a sick patient or someone I don't think is fit for surgery to the operating room.
I like that.
And again, maybe this is one of those reasons that you don't go down to the place that sees as many as they can, as you know, because then they probably are making decisions or not checking you out or ensuring that you are safe. They're just collecting your money.
Yeah.
I do think one question, if we're talking about fears, and I have a few colleagues in town who send me patients because they don't operate at a hospital. They all have privileges, but they don't. They have their own surgery centers or surgical suites in their offices. So some of them will not take on the patient. Some of them like have an age limit. I don't want to do anywhere over 65. It's too high risk. We don't know what we're going to find. They may not have, like you were asking, Ashlyn, or maybe they have an undiagnosed heart problem. Mm-hmm. They don't want to deal with cardiac clearances. Or patients who are on blood thinners, patients who have pacemakers or defibrillators. Like, these are all high-risk patients in an anesthesia sense and also in a surgery sense, mm-hmm. From a surgical perspective. And they're very smart. They're very safe. They're like, hey, go see Dr. Batis because he does surgeries at a hospital. So I do think if you think you're high-risk, or if you're like, well, yeah, I have a pacemaker or I've had a heart attack or a stroke, is it a good idea? That's a question for your surgeon. Is it a good idea to do this in your office here? I think that question is definitely worth asking, and potentially exploring. Like, okay, maybe I want you as my surgeon, but if you're not going to take me to a hospital, maybe I'm not comfortable doing this in a surgery center or like an office based surgery suite.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Check into that. Like, where is the surgery at? Ask that question. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because even though mine was in an office suite, it backed up to the OR.
Oh, so perfect.
It was an office suite that the
so
other
so you're a healthy patient. So
yeah,
so and you are a healthy patient.
No, but that made me feel better. Where I was like, if anything happened, she's like, no, the door the door opens and that's the OR. I was like, oh, they didn't have to call an ambulance and move me from.
Oh,
one
right,
side.
Right, right.
Like that's just the way the room is or their suite is set up. It backs up to the OR.
Nice.
I mean, I think one of the things maybe patients or I think sometimes doctors like forget too is for most bariatric patients, once you come to the point of seeing me, you've either cut down or altogether eliminated your diabetic drugs, right? Like your diabetes is either almost cured or cured. High blood pressure is usually not an issue. Lungs are improved. So, a lot of these things that made you sick, let's say, or overall worse health have all come down to a point where most patients probably could be at a surgery center. But it's funny because the anesthesiologists are going through the history too. And like a lot of the times, the first time they meet you is in the pre-op area. And I hate this past medical history, the way we've designed it in medicine. Like if you once had high blood pressure when you were obese and now you no longer have it, it still stays. And I'm kind of like, well, I mean, it's called past medical history, but this doesn't apply anymore. Like we should just take it off your history. But then the anesthesiologist looks and is like, oh, this patient's diabetic and they have high blood pressure and obstructive sleep apnea. I'm like, you're doing this 9-hour case. I'm like, yeah, those were all old. Like they don't apply anymore. Those patients lost 100 pounds. So I don't know if you ran into that problem, Ashlyn, of like the anesthesiologist kind of freaking out the first time you had surgery. And then
I actually more have that issue in non-plastic, non-bariatric. Like I went for a vein procedure and I swear the anesthesiologist like walked in the room and like walked out of the room and then walked back in the room and kind of looked at me. And I was like,
Probably wondering why you have like 13 things listed on your past medical history and, you know, you're this young woman who looks healthy.
Well, I think the thing that throws them off is because I'm on a GLP-1, I need to have the highest level of obesity that I've ever had. And that stays in my medical record. And so when they open the door,
that might be why too.
Expecting to see, and I know exactly what it is. And I'm always just like, you're questioning if I am me because it says in my chart that I am like morbidly obese.
BMI of 46 or something. Right. Yeah, some crazy number.
And they're like, yes. And I'm like, I.
But that should also, go, I mean, I delete that from patients' charts. Yeah. I'm like, that's like silly. It doesn't apply anymore.
But I do think it is important to acknowledge that obesity is a lifelong disease. And even though I'm in a smaller body, I still need treatment for obesity. So it's like this weird, I think that having obesity highest resolved is a better than, because if you remove it all together, then the insurance is going to say you don't need treatment of obesity. It's another decision for another conversation.
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
But it is, I've had doctors, or even like I was getting at Mayo, you come like a week ahead and anytime you have surgery and you do this year and sits
PAT,
with you.
Yeah.
I think the last one kind of sat and looked at me and looked at my chart and I could tell she was like checking. And I'm like, no, it's me.
It's me.
It's my chart. I know. It's crazy. And they're like, oh, you had bariatric. Yes. Yeah. I'm like, I know. It's confusing.
Well, and guys, if you don't have someone actually checking this stuff, then that's also a sign that you probably shouldn't be there. So that can help some fears. I think it's just if you go in with an open mind and you ask a lot of questions, I think this can really help you eliminate a lot of those fears and look up statistics and realize like we're walking around sometimes and just driving. And it's actually a way bigger chance of us getting hurt than it is to be, you know, under plastic surgery. So is there any last things you guys want to wrap up on? Cause I do feel like you guys should have a therapist also, like make sure you have one of those. That way, if you do have these fears, then
I would say that's kind of my takeaway. Like if this is keeping you up at night and it is really not resolving with kind of some questions, some answers, one, be very frank. If you have a history of abuse, it may be important for your surgeon to know that, just on a level of this is how I may react or this is how I may feel. And also, so it's just out in the open. So if something embarrassing or your fear does come true, they understand and are not going to prosecute you. They're not going to do anything towards you. But like we have it covered. It's understood that this is like, again, a professional setting. But if those fears are keeping you up at night, contact a therapist who knows something about plastics and knows something about like or any surgical fears. There are many of us, but specific to that kind of anxiety and be open about it. It's okay. I always tell bariatrics and plastics, let whoever know, the first person that asks you, like, I am anxious. I don't want to be here, but I want to be here. And you're like, okay, let somebody know that so that we can medicate you. If you're worried you're going to vomit after surgery, tell someone that. We'll medicate you for it. Like, verbalize the fears so we can help you deal with them.
I think that's probably the best takeaway, right? I mean, like I told you, sometimes I walk in and one of the first things they say after good morning is like, oh, I'm really nervous. And it's like, okay, well, let's mark you, right? I need you to stand. I need you to be able to stand. And then once we're done with the markings, I'll have the nurse give you the medication. A lot of the times it's already ordered. They just haven't given it to you because they know I'm going to stand you up. And if they've given you the medication, I'm not going to be happy with them because I'm going to need to hold you up to do my markings, which is not an easy task to do with two hands. So
not by any means.
I think verbalize, ask questions. For sure have a therapist. Call Ashlyn. Ashlyn, can you see people outside of Florida?
No, just Florida. No. And actually, I'm like randomly licensed in Virginia, but I just had some clients move to Virginia. So yeah, okay. I've been to Virginia randomly.
I operated on a lady from Virginia like last week, I think, or 2 weeks ago now.
Oh, so. There you go.
Yeah, I randomly had two clients move to Virginia. So I was like, I'll just get like, and they were super easy to get licensed there, like ridiculously easy. So
do you, we're getting off topic here. Do you have a license that gives you like reciprocal licenses or no?
Social workers do not have that yet. Psychologists have it. It's called PsychPAC, and mental health counselors, licensed professional counselors, literally theirs is going live next year. Ours is stuck in litigation, or not in legislation, rather. So the states have to enact it, and then they have to decide how much it costs, and then who gets the money, and then what do you do? And the mental health provider counselors have figured out a really good system. So I have a feeling the social workers are just going to copy theirs once it goes live. Yeah, but the state of Florida has not enacted it. So if you,
what exactly are you talking about? Like if you enact it, what happens?
So I could more easily work in multiple states.
Yes.
So,
okay.
Yes.
That's like what she I could thought. Do televisits with California or correct. Whatever states are California. Part of that. So the states have to be part of that.
If I ever move out of state, I can still see my lady.
Correct. So, yes. So if you want to do some legislation advocacy and you have a therapist that moved and you really want to see them, counseling PsychPAC, social work comp, PsychPAC through California probably is never going to be on that list. But again, another conversation for another day.
Nursing's done a good job with that. Like nurses have I think it's called a compact license, and it's like 13 or 20, I don't know, a certain number of states. I don't know any. Yeah, I don't know much about it.
I think PsychPAC is actually based on the nursing one. So, I mean, it works well. I mean, it's expensive, but.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the deal is like you pay for quality. So just remember that. Be intentional with your dollars, people. Quality surgeons, quality therapists. Yes, yes. If it feels like it's a burden turn, it probably is. And I'm going to plug our sponsor, findabariatrictherapist.com. Like if you guys need a therapist, go to that website. Yes. Type in all your information and she will find
you. And if you cannot find one that's listed, all the emails on all my sites go to me. So just shoot me an email from that website. There's a contact me page and just say, hey, I need someone in rural Alaska. And oddly enough, I usually can find you one. So if you don't have anyone listed for your state or near you or your insurance, just shoot me an email. I've worked some like crazy ones that I'm like, there's no way I'm going to be able to find that. And then I do. So.
Yeah, she good works girl. Her magic. Ashlyn knows all the people all over the world. Well, thank you guys so much for that talk. I can't wait to keep going with this part of the series because I know we have a lot of fears and we're going to address them individually, guys. So don't you worry. We'll have the next one out next week. So thank you guys. And thank you for being on, Dr. Betas and Ashlyn. And until next time, guys, be safe.
Bye. Thanks. Bye.